Hi, and welcome to the Creative Climate Leadership Podcast. This is a podcast about the radical leading role of the arts in this age of converging crises. I'm your host, Emanuela, aka Emma Blake Morsi, and in this series, we speak to those doing remarkable work behind the curtains and on stage to generate systemic change in the creative sector and beyond. Really excited to be able to explore a bit more in depth today about our past and present and future policy, getting a bit more into legislative challenges and cultural exchange opportunities. How can platforms such as UNFCCC Conference of Parties drive change? In what ways could Indigenous communities and cultural discussions influence international and local policy? We are joined by Solveig Kurum, who's a senior advisor for culture and sustainability for Culture Tanken, and also took part in CCR Scandinavia in 2022, and Ri Alkemada, who's a project officer for cultural relations platform, and also took part in CCR Benelux.
So my name is Ri. I'm a project officer at the cultural relations platform, which is a project that's funded by the EU. We're based in Brussels. And we work on engaging in sustainable, long-term and meaningful cultural relations activities between EU institutions and partner countries. On a more personal level, I'm Japanese and I'm Dutch. And my background is actually primarily more in working in the visual arts sector. I've worked with a lot of small-scale organizations in the field of cultural exchange and also some larger festivals, looking at how visual arts can be used to discuss large-scale societal topics.
Yes, my name is Solveig Kurum, and I work with Kulturtanken, Arts for Young Audiences Norway, which is an underlying agency of the Norwegian Ministry of Cultural Affairs. Well, right now I work with Kulturtanken, but I've also been working across different underlying agencies with the ministry and closely also with the ministry to look at how we develop cultural policy to advance the sustainability goal and the climate in particular. And my background is from music. I have a PhD where I wrote about the role of music in international development. So basically about how the role music takes in society and in different contexts, especially in developing countries. Also, I have background in tree planting from Senegal. I used to live there and run a tree planting project.
We're getting to a whole conversation about it. Actually, what is cultural policy? What does that mean? Solveig, would you like to put forward a definition for us to explore today?
Well, I think that would be very useful, at least, for us to have like a point of departure, because I do think both with cultural policy and even the word culture in itself is one of the most complicated words to define. It's basically, with culture, it's basically the difference between this broad lifestyle concept that refers to all domains in life, and also kind of that the opposition to that, or kind of part of that, is that sectorial understanding, like cultural sector as a limited sector of society for cultural heritage and artistic creativity, and the products of the sector and the institutions and all that ecosystem within the sector. And I do think in terms of climate action, both those understandings are very relevant, because it is ultimately about building a new culture in our society. How we interact, which kind of images we see, how we imagine the futures, how we relate to each other. You know, all this is basically part of that broader cultural picture. But in terms of cultural policy, which is what we will talk about right now, I do think it would be useful to kind of limit that conception to talking about the government actions, laws and programs and the toolbox that we have to regulate and protect and encourage through plans, but also financially and otherwise support activities related to the arts and the creative sectors, and also to the cultural heritage sector. And then, and I also think it's important to state that cultural policy, it's not only something that we do at the national level. It can be on the international level, like the EU, for example, and other bodies on the international level. It's very national at the level of each country, but then you also have regional and local cultural policies. And all this together is kind of like the sum of all what we will talk about in this episode, I guess.
And so with that kind of context as a baseline, I would love to put forward for you both to kind of explore as an open provocation. How do you feel like culture should inform policy decision making?
I think one of the things that is a really big strength of the cultural sector, and by that I mean people working in the artistic and creative arts, as Solveig pointed out, is that there's a lot of room there for experimentation, for creative thinking, for being out of the box. And I think a lot of that can link to policy making to be slightly more innovative and sort of try to be, as you pointed out, Manuela, less rigid, less bureaucratic. I think there is this really strong potential for cultural sectors to promote more out-of-the-box thinking. And I think that is something that is necessary when you look at where we are in the world at the moment. A lot of times with climate change, for example, we need to do things maybe a little differently. We need to change the way people think, which will hopefully then lead to changing the way people act, react, do things. And I think, and speaking as someone who's from the cultural sector, I think there is this really strong potential there that we could look at exploring more. And the way policy can do that is by facilitating those kind of creative thinkings, exchanges, and collaborations. I think that's really such a strong potential that we can tap into moving forward in having slightly more innovative ways of working. I think that's maybe just as a basis, a good starting point.
Well, I do think it's very interesting to look at how cultural policy has moved from being like, from focusing on the arts and aesthetics, not only, but mainly, and into addressing broader concerns in society. And we have seen this shift, about culture, how it should provide like high quality experiences and participatory experience to as many people as possible. So kind of making culture accessible to marginalized groups, and not only accessible, but also kind of making their cultural expressions part of, you know, what we consider valuable of supporting in cultural policy. And also kind of moving from there to how cultural policy now is kind of evolving into a driver itself or enabler of social change. And that's something that I'm kind of seeing a big shift right now, both in kind of how cultural policy is made, but also kind of what we are talking about. Because I read this academic article recently by this Norwegian researcher, Per Mongset, and he argues that cultural policy, it's actually, we see a crisis in cultural policy. And his argument is that there are like 7 challenges, and those are that we have big challenge in democratizing culture, speaking about all these different groups and the minorities and all that. So that's one challenge. And also kind of how public support for culture is also like outdated in many ways, and we tend to keep on support to the traditional cultural institutions and the ecosystem that we used to know from before, which is probably not that relevant anymore. And that's something that we need to address. And then we also see how artists continue to struggle with poverty despite of public support schemes in this. So that's also an issue that we must, you know, think differently to address. And also something that we see, which is very much linked to, you know, the issue that we're talking about, the climate and sustainability goals, is that how cultural policy tends to remain very national in spite of, artists operating more globally, but also kind of how these, you know, issues that we need to tackle are also more and more global issues. So how do you go about that? That's also, yeah, something. So I shouldn't list all the, you know, all the challenges, but they are just some of them. That are there. And also one important point is that, you know, in time of crisis, we see that there is a big pressure on the public budget. And then with all this crisis going on and all the fronts, it's very difficult to legitimate somehow an increased support to culture unless we make ourselves relevant as part of the solutions to the crises that we are fronting, meeting in our society. So I do think that we have this legitimacy crisis for cultural policy right now, but there is also a potential solution when linking it to the climate and linking it to the sustainability goals and the broader picture. And that doesn't mean that we should instrumentalize culture and cultural action in itself. It should be free. Artists should be free. Expression should be free. It's not what I'm saying, but we should be able to support that and be able to talk about the importance of it and the meaning of it and the impact on the society level as well. and keep those thoughts in mind at the same time.
We touched on something that really excited me, which is, you know, ultimately for yourself, even Solveig, what does decentralizing power mean to you? And what do you think its role is in driving like those cultural shifts?
To do deep listening, to listen to the groups that are not, that do necessarily, that hasn't had power up to now and that has not been heard in those kind of more formal bureaucratic contexts into now. Because we are very good at, you know, putting like participatory processes and we should listen and all that. But in terms of doing it, really doing it and doing it rightly and from the right space in ourselves, I do think that we have a long way to go still. Because it's, if we say that we will listen to people, it's also that we commit, or we should commit at least, to do things differently. And I do think that the system itself, the bureaucracy, is kind of a system that was created to maintain itself, just to put it like, to say it like in a very tabloid way. But
I mean, that's the truth.
Yeah, no, but it's there for a reason. And I do think the need is there to kind of maintain certain, this continuity. We shouldn't kind of overthrow the whole system and just create a revolution. We should make it into a healthy evolution. And then, but as part of that evolution, there's a lot of, you know, this, how can I say? Like, we are not open enough to really kind of infiltrate the voices that should be part of the new we and the new society into our decision-making rooms and decision-making processes and the documents that we ultimately produce that make the premises for the, for this new age.
Absolutely. And I think actually kind of going to you as well, V, I think oftentimes we can have some like misconceptions around not just cultural policy, but how it can, the impacts it can have and what it really, how it can influence the way we live. I wondered for yourself, is there any kind of common misconceptions on cultural policy that you kind of encounter in your like day-to-day work as well?
I think the biggest misconception with cultural policy that I come across being someone from the cultural sector is that it only benefits artists or people who are creating things. I think all of us here and probably most of the people listening to this podcast know that the cultural and creative sectors consists of so much more of an ecosystem than just artists. I mean, artists are integral, don't get me wrong. They're very important to the sector and, you know, they should be supported and we should facilitate the creative expressions. But there are so many other positions within these sectors that also fall in the ecosystem of cultural policy. I think that's one misconception. I think another misconception is that cultural policy is frivolous. It just is supporting a nice hobby for a lot of people to create nice things. And I think I don't know a single person who has not consumed some form of culture. I mean, we all watch films, we all read books, we all listen to music, and most of the artistic production touches on societal issues, global issues. So I think the conception of cultural policy being somewhat frivolous, and as Solveig said, this is why funding tends to get cut quite easily. That is a big misconception with regards to cultural policy from people who I think don't particularly engage with the field. And I think that with regards to sort of the deep listening, I think that's also really important for policymakers, because one of the issues, well, if we call it an issue, one of the issues with culture and creative sectors is that a lot of our value systems are more qualitative rather than, I always get this word wrong, quantitative. I mean, it's easy with perhaps other fields and sectors to quantify success, right? How many deals were made in the past year? How much carbon emissions were reduced in the past quarter? I mean, these are a lot of times numbers driven. Whereas with culture, how do you measure the impact something had on someone's well-being? How do you measure the impact it had on someone's way of thinking? These are things that are really difficult to measure. Yeah, exactly. And yet somehow we find ourselves still in this box of trying to evaluate cultural policy outcomes in very numbers-driven ways. I think there needs to be a little bit of shift in how this is done, because this is how we end up falling into this trap of, oh, well, cultural, the programs we're funding in culture are not working because we don't know how to measure the effect. And a lot of times, if you think of it in the ways of changing the way people think, creating a new culture, these things take time. They're not done overnight. They take years.
Actually, I mean, even when you think back to COVID as a time that, you know, for many people hasn't stopped, I think contextualizing that's important. But actually, when you think about how much culture was integral to kind of upkeeping just the sense of humanity, I think we kind of really lent on not just even just entertainment, but lent on, you know, many different types of art forms to kind of, you know, help us at a time where you are so disconnected.
I think there's a lot of wonderful people out there who are trying to change the way we evaluate cultural policy, cultural programming, cultural monitoring and evaluation. So I'm unfortunately not an expert in this topic, but I know there are a lot of people out there who are trying to make a shift in that side. I have to say one thing that cultural policy, from what I can see currently working in the EU space, so this is what I can comment on now, sort of funding and cultural policy at an EU level currently, they are trying to incorporate elements of tackling climate change and sort of sustainability in their criteria. So for example, I know that for some EU-funded programs, if you'd like to apply for funding, you have to demonstrate consideration of environmental actions and factors. So you have to clearly outline, for example, that you are initiating this action plan to travel less, maybe host more online meetings instead of, you know, in-person meetings. And another thing that often comes up is there might be a financial incentive for more sustainable travel, particularly for mobility grants. These are just things that I have been seeing sort of in my surroundings. So cultural policy is shifting a bit in that sense. And I think that's one of the positives at an EU level, is that they are really identifying that this is an important need in cultural policy making moving forward and funding. So I like to think that in that sense, they are listening to people who are actually the ones who are requesting the funding. However, of course, I think the other downside of this is that, so through my work, I'm quite fortunate in being able to interact with a lot of cultural practitioners around the world because we work internationally. And a lot of the cultural practitioners, artists that I have a chance to speak to are really passionate about engaging more in climate change work, you know, engaging in more sustainable practices, want to see how they and the cultural sectors can work together with people working in climate change. But they're not really sure where to start. They don't really know how to engage on that topic at a deeper level, rather than just, I run a theater and we would like to install solar panels. I mean, of course, this is important, but sometimes, you know, you want to do more, you want to be able to collaborate on a more long-term level. And I think these are the kind of things that perhaps cultural policy can support, in that we should try working more outside of our own silos. If cultural policy already is starting to move in that direction of incorporating green elements, sustainability, why not take it a step further and facilitate collaboration with other sectors, for example? I mean, why not try to have a cultural center work more outside of just the cultural sector and work more with, off the top of my head, maybe environmental scientists, people working in sustainable food systems. I don't know. I mean, I think this is something we can take it a step further.
And I wonder, because, you know, we've kind of talked about the, you know, the, how the value systems themselves can evolve. Even just from yourself, sort of like, you know, climate and environmental action can often be seen as kind of outside the remit of cultural policy. Yet, you know, when you think about culture, I mean, from like the world we live in, for myself, it seems like a very obvious point to ignore when you don't think about the very place that we live in, we exist within. And I wonder, you know, how do you kind of see this? How are you seeing this change, maybe? And what would be your vision for a culture policy with climate at its heart?
Well, from my point of view, I think we need to think broader than just the greening of the cultural sector itself. It's important, it's practical, it's technical, it's very kind of, we know what we need to do and we are partly doing it, and we could do more, of course, but that's only one part of the picture. Because I do think that there are other parts of cultural policy that has a potentially big role to play in this that are kind of ignored or not so much talked about when we talk about cultural policy and how it's linked to the environment and climate issues. And in addition to the greening of the sector aspect that we already touched upon, I would like to highlight the kind of cultural policy's role to protect and promote cultural heritage, cultural practices and rights. And this includes work to preserve and further develop and protect the cultural heritage and all the associated competences like linked to it, and especially related to indigenous people and minorities. And like in Norway and across the Nordic countries, we have this indigenous group called Sapmis. We also have other indigenous groups and minorities groups whose lives and kind of, you know, their holistic way of working and being is closely connected to the nature and to the cycles of nature and understanding nature and kind of really thinking and working and living and being in very sustainable ways. So I do think that we have so much to learn from them. And we also have, this obligation to protect their rights and to enable that they can continue to live that way and continue to do their cultural practices. And also another thing, which is linked to that, which is not necessarily only linked to the indigenous groups, but more broadly, is that we have this cultural policy can play a big role in kind of protecting cultural expressions and practices that are threatened by climate change. And that's like we had this storm in Norway last summer, and which affected some areas, which are also areas of cultural practices and even buildings that we need to protect. So all these things are part of this bigger picture of promoting and protecting the cultural heritage and the cultural landscapes also.
And I think we're actually seeing that on a policy level being recognised more in value. I mean, there's still a very long way to go, but even recently for COP, that recognizing of the loss and damage fund as a real acknowledgement of actually these adverse effects that often many of the most vulnerable and marginalized kind of regions of the world in terms of the global south have been so adversely impacted. And so for me, it's like you've touched that really importantly on the head, is actually that value of what's being lost, but also that kind of how can we protect that moving forward? How can we recognize the loss historically and also prevent further losses from occurring?
Can I also add just a small thing to that, small note? Because that's not only a question of cultural policy, it's also a question of legal rights, because we have these international conventions, like for example, this Convention on the Protection of the Intangible Cultural Heritage from 2003, which many countries, among them Norway, has signed, and also the FARA Convention from 2005. There is also this UNESCO Convention of Cultural Diversity from 2005 also. And very recently in 2022, we got this Mondia Cult Declaration from Mexico. So all these are UNESCO conventions and EU framework conventions that we have an obligation to respect and to implement regardless of the political, you know, leadership that we have in our country and regardless of the policies as such that we are making right now. This is a broader issue, and this is something that we have agreed on as a platform to build actions on.
I fully agree that, giving voices to marginalized communities, indigenous communities, this is so incredibly important in almost every region, every country. It's really a global topic to be discussed. One of the problems I find with cultural policy is that it can be quite inaccessible for people who are not familiar with it. So these UNESCO conventions, they are incredibly important, of course, in setting sort of global frameworks. But a lot of people don't really understand how to approach the language. What do these conventions even mean? It becomes very highfalutin, very difficult to follow. If you're not in it, you don't get it. As someone who's currently working in the cultural policy space, I can see how if you work in, I'm sure this is the same with any policy, actually. If you work in a group of people that are constantly used to certain jargons, you're used to the frameworks, you sometimes maybe forget how that communicates to people not working in the policy field. And I think this is something that we always need to try to remember when you're in the field of policymaking to make it accessible to just the general public, so to speak.
For yourself, even so, like, what potential do you see for almost organizations and even businesses to kind of drive positive cultural change, considering that a lot of times they can also uphold these existing systems that can be quite limiting?
Well, I do think that there is a lot of great initiatives going on out there already. There are a lot of organizations who are very engaged in this, a lot of individual artists who have like, they have great crowds and they reach a lot of people to create like awareness and do sensitization and do mobilization across society. So I do think that the role of artists and the role of organizations is like really, really crucial. And then a challenge for us as policymakers is really how do we, you know, capture that in our policymaking and make, well, like find good policy tools to enable the artists and organizations who want to do that kind of work to be able to do it and do it more. And how can we create support programs that can be directed specifically to support artistic projects relating to the themes of sustainability? In Norway, as per now, we don't have that. There is no scheme where artists can apply for grants if they want to do something, community work or some sensitization, or even if there are, you know, people who want to collaborate across the field of art, education, academia, and, you know, across, you know, we were earlier talking about this need to work across sectors and across different activities in society. And as per now, there is nowhere to go, at least in Norway, to apply for funding. I know that there are, you know, more advanced in the EU, for example, and there are some countries have that, but we don't have it. And as part of that, we should be able to like fund artistic commissions that link to this, foster research that links to this, and also kind of, yeah, just whatever initiatives that promote sharing of resources, ideas, and knowledge and debate that links to this is something that we as policymakers should be able to support and find good solutions to capture and make it like accessible and fair for everyone.
In this kind of wider visioning or reimagining of how we kind of see culture at play. And I wondered, you know, in this space of dreaming and reimagining, what kind of experimental, and especially I feel like, because, you know, some of the work that you do, I think there's so much opportunity in that kind of intercultural exchange of different kind of dynamics across the board, different kind of countries who are sharing resources, sharing information, collaborating in new ways. And I wonder what kind of experimental new intercultural exchange systems would you like to see more of?
This is a difficult question to answer. it requires a lot of imagination. I think for me, it would be nice if we could all slow down a bit and just spend some more time. This is going to sound incredibly basic, but maybe this is what we need. Just talking to people. I think we've lost that ability recently because everything is very geopolitically tense. Everyone is quite polarized. There's a lot of, you know, high emotions at stake. I mean, the climate crisis is obviously super urgent. People are anxious. I think it would be really nice in future. And I think this would really promote better policymaking if we're able to talk to people from different cultures to learn more about what people are doing, what people are thinking. And ultimately, the point of that is really to build trust. I think we need to build trust to like have good policymaking. I think that's just basic. And I think this links back again to what seems to be the underlying theme of like interdisciplinary practices and approaches. We tend to stick to people we know and people who think like us and people who work in the same field as ourselves. And I think if we're able to sort of slowly break down those silos and we actually talk to other people, it would really change the way we think a lot. So as part of my work, we run an annual learning program called the Global Cultural Relations Program. Traditionally, it's for cultural practitioners, but last year, for the first time, we actually opened participation to non-cultural practitioners. So normally, we invite 40 participants working across the creative and cultural sectors, but last year, for the first time, half the participants worked in the field of climate change and environment. So we literally had people who worked in circular economy research. We had people working in agriculture and sustainable food systems. We had people who were sustainability consultants for corporates. And half the room were cultural practitioners. There were artists, there were people working in cultural policy, people working at UNESCO. And I think more of this kind of work of just slowing down and talking to people would be a really, really good way to just sort of build trust, get to know people better. I think just by having a one-day conversation with someone you never would have otherwise been in a room with really changes a lot of things. And maybe this is a bit of a sort of utopian kind of, I wish life was like this, but that would be really nice if cultural policy can facilitate sort of that more slow connections.
I think
at a global level.
I think that's incredibly powerful. And I think almost sometimes we feel like we need to be doing the solution, something that's really new or really innovative, that is something that's groundbreaking that we've never heard of before. But actually, oftentimes, it's sort of the reconnection to the things that we've almost lost in many ways as a value.
Yeah. And just on that point quickly, just because that makes me think, for example, traditionally in Japan, you know, when we had more of the traditional times, you know, you thought, and I'm sure this is the same in other cultures, but, you know, there was, you know, the river had a god, the mountain had a god. They were actually living things, right? And I think that if you talk to different cultures where they view things in a very different way from the way we view things, like just that little spark kind of really changes a lot, I would like to think.
We actually have a toolbox for increased sensory experiences. And our we like by doing art and being part of artistic communities, we increase our ability to observe and to sense and connect with the world. And we get this alternative language of presence. And I do think that that's kind of affect how we relate to nature, to each other, and also kind of what motivations we have to act for all these issues, right? When we not only, well, like when we know and feel the urgency, not only with our brains, but also with our hearts and in our hands and with everything, it's kind of easier to act. And it, well, I would rephrase that, because in any case, it's not easy to act on these issues. It's a hard struggle every day to get up and think that we have to make a shift. We have to change the world. It's a complicated thing. It's a hard thing. But when you have that motivation, when you feel that urgency in your body, you, at least you have a motivation that comes from a different space. So I do think that that's important. And kind of, and then coming back to the policy level of that, I do think it's important that we as policy makers make grants, collaboration arenas, communication channels, and events where these issues can kind of come into play. And programs. I would like to share one example from a school in Norway that we had this. Well, like it was actually the University of Oslo doing the sustainability program, collaborating with some students. And they were actually studying how the salmon was migrating in the local river here in Oslo. And of course, they learned it at school in the science class and everything. They learned all the details and the science behind it. But then they were kind of challenged on how, you know, on making it a more artistic thing and a sensory thing. And then one group of students, they actually made their own salmon wetsuits, and they actually jumped into the river and they filmed it, and they were kind of making this whole, and of course they were having a lot of fun and they were laughing, and it was just like socially great and interesting thing for them to do as well. But on the learning level and on the sustainability level, that's something that they will remember afterwards. And that's a sensory experience that they can connect to the science that they have learned. And then I do think that we should facilitate more and more of these collaborations and using the artistic toolbox in arenas where it hasn't up to now been fully used, like in the schools, like in, you know, just for big companies, workshops for big companies taking, or even in the parliament. You know, I heard that in the parliament in England, they're having this mindfulness classes. So why shouldn't we bring art tools into those processes as well? So there is this potential there that is not yet fully liberated.
I'm very aware of timings, and I kind of would love us to kind of be able to provide to our listeners some sort of tangible call to action. Can you even share about a particular work or project that you're working on as well?
I have two. The first is, if you're a cultural practitioner and you're working for an organization, I'm going to say within the EU, just because that's the space I'm in now, speak up, have a chance to go to some of these dialogues with people representing commission departments. A lot of opportunities exist for people, policymakers, to listen to cultural practitioners. Some mechanisms are out there. So if you happen to be a cultural practitioner within the EU, join a network, see if there's an opportunity for you to join a dialogue. The opportunities are out there. So I would suggest maybe you have a look. And on a more accessible level, in case you're not based in the EU or you are not interested in discussing anything with policymakers, which is okay, break out of your silo a bit, maybe. And I would say try finding a podcast or something about climate change that's not linked to culture at all. It might be a bit daunting. It's something I've started doing recently, and I think that is a nice way to slowly learn more outside your bubble.
Well, for the policy nerds and for people who are kind of interested in figuring out ways of balancing this pragmatic need to measure things, but also considering kind of that intrinsic and particular relevance of culture, I would like to recommend a document by UNESCO called the Thematic Indicators of Culture in the 2030 Agenda. It's a framework for thematic indicators whose purpose is to measure and monitor the progress of culture's contribution to the goals. And it's done in a very good way, because it's not only about the numbers or the statistics, it's also about measuring trends and seeing kind of directions and telling the story about where we are, where and how we are moving in connection to the sustainability goals and the climate goal as well. So that's one nerdy thing. And I would also like to recommend a song, actually, which is not the climate song as such, but this was born from a joint climate initiative by one Norwegian artist called Marte Wulf and another artist from Bangladesh called Shamin Sultan Nashumi. And both of them are climate activists and artists in their countries. And they created this song called Let the Light In. And maybe if we have the chance, we can go out at the end of this podcast by playing it. I don't know if you have the chance, but it's a beautiful song.
I want to thank you both so much for all of your contributions for today's episode. Thanks for joining us. What have you taken away from this episode? Feel free to share your thoughts with us using hashtag CCL podcast. And you can find links to resources mentioned in the description of this episode or visit the CCL website at creativeclimateleadership.com for more information. This podcast is constructed by the Creative Climate Leadership Alumni Network, an evolving network growing from the CCL programme led by Julie's Bicycle, a pioneering UK-based non-profit mobilising the arts and culture to take action on the climate and ecological crisis. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to the Creative Climate Leadership podcast and get in touch with us on ccl@juliesbicycle.com. This podcast is produced by Hum Studio Interactive in co-creation with Julie's Bicycle. We thank our sponsors Nordic Culture Fund, Swedish Postcode Lottery, and Porticus.